Hey, influencer, welcome back to part two of our interview with Kenneth Vogt. And in case if you missed part one yesterday, you'll definitely want to go back and check it out because Kenneth just shared so much marketing gold. It was absolutely unbelievable. And today, in part two, you'll get to hear how to assess what a prospect would be like to work with before you decide to sign them up. Also, what authenticity in your marketing has got to do with the results, and what are some of the interesting metrics versus the metrics that really matter in your marketing. Kenneth also shared how to factor in downtime after an event when considering speaking gigs, and how he taught himself to turn himself off and stop thinking about business before going to sleep. So without any further ado, here's Kenneth Vogt. This is Esther Kish.
And this is Meta Muller.
And you just caught the latest episode of Born to Influence, the marketing show.
We are taught to be very specific about our niche and be very specific about talking to a very targeted audience. And it might be something like, well, I only want to work with the go-getters. I only want to attract people who are already in motion, for example. So how would you use the methods that you explained here to use it for something like that?
Okay. Well, if I can speak specifically of something in spiral dynamics, there's the level of orange. Orange is about achievement. It's about accomplishment. And people at that level, you'll see a lot of entrepreneurs who are orange. That's their thing. And if you can go straight for those people. And some people do this because they like the excitement of that crowd. They like the energy of those people. There's a downside to some of these folks though too, because they're all about bending the rules. They're all about making it work for themselves, and you know that can make them somewhat hard to manage. You know, they can be rock stars. They can be a little volatile. So you have to decide if that really matters to you. I know this whole talk about niche. It's a difficult one. It's at the beginning when you first have some kind of entrepreneurial urge, your inclination is, I want to sell this to everybody. Everybody needs what I offer, right?
And the whole world.
Yeah, the whole world needs this. And that doesn't work for a neophyte marketer. You will not survive that. You will be beat to death by the people who are hard targeting specific areas. But as a company expands and grows and matures, they actually can go after that. And that's why a company like Google, they don't shoot for – their idea of niche is the human race. Now, and they can do that because they've matured to that level. But you have to pay your dues before you can get there. So niche is something that makes sense, and there is a point when niche no longer will make sense. And you're not there because you want to be there. You're there because you're there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. And I think I just want to take you up on you were going into spiral dynamics and looking at, well, who exactly are we talking to and so forth, and one of the let's just call them groups that you mentioned were the orange group, the achievers, and so forth, a bit more material oriented, and sort of immediately in my mind, I was getting two different companies, L'Oreal, you know, because you're worth it, and so forth, and then Body Shop with, you know, Save the World and Animals and Save the Planet and so forth, which really are talking to two very different people. You know, who knows? The product might be the same. I do not know. But it is, it's two completely different groups of people with two completely different worldviews that we're talking to here. And it works. There's a reason why Body Shop works. There's a reason why their branding and their marketing has worked so incredibly well, because they have targeted or they have focused on one particular group of people with one particular worldview, so to say, or one aspiration as to what they want the world to look like.
Sure, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you know, you can't make the L'Oreal crowd wrong, because they aren't as evolved as the Body Shop crowd. They are being who they are. They're being the best they know how to be.
Yeah, and I'm fairly sure I recall reading an article a few years ago that L'Oreal even bought. I may be wrong, but I think it's owned by the same company. Both of them.
Nice.
So, that's when you get to talk to everyone.
I entered their lists. That's great.
Yeah, that allows people to. They're going to service people where they are, and that's fantastic. I love that. That sounds fantastic.
Yeah. Exactly.
So what is it that you do when you're working with people? How do you teach them to be able to have that impact, or do you look at the level of colors, or what is the most important when you're first starting trying to get them out of that phase of being frazzled and putting out fires?
Well, the first thing that really matters is figuring out what their own personal needs are. Mm-hmm. That because that's just absolutely foundational. I mean, that is the rock bottom of it all. And everybody I've encountered has had some flaws there that they didn't realize were there. And just shining a light on it, they go, "Oh man, look at that! Yeah, of course." And you just watch all these things just kind of go ka-chunk, 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 and shift over to where it needs to be. And it might make subtle changes for them. Decisions they'll come to on their own. I don't tell anybody what to do in their business. I don't take over their companies. You know, I don't want to take over their companies. They're already good at what they do. But I do want to shine a light on it. And I like the analogy of coaching to explain it, because if you look in the athletic world, all professional athletes have coaches, all of them, and not just the teams, even individuals. So you take somebody like Serena Williams in tennis. She has a coach. Well, she's arguably one of the best tennis players who ever lived. Why on earth would she need somebody to teach her anything? Well, that's not really the point. It's just somebody with an outside perspective, somebody that can say to her, "Hey, Serena, you're pitching the ball about 2 inches too low on the serve." She immediately knows what to do with that. Got it. Thanks. And she corrects and continues to be the world-class athlete that she is. Well, her coach can't beat her at tennis. No way. Now, her coach can probably beat me at tennis. You know, I'm sure they're good at it, you know, but you know, I can coach people in business who are in many ways my superior, at least in their business. But I do know how to look from the outside in, and I don't have any skin in the game. I don't have any attachment to anything that they're doing or failing to do. I can just see what's there. That's a gift of mine. And then it's up to them to internalize that.
So how do you help someone who may not be open to hear the advice once they signed on as a client? Because sometimes you have to deal with egos, or they just don't get it because they don't see it from the perspective that you have.
Well, one of the things that I've learned is to assess people early on to know whether or not I can work with them.
Okay.
It's like, again, in spiral dynamics, if somebody's red, they're pretty difficult to work with. You know, and there are other levels they wouldn't even come to me, because their consciousness isn't high enough that they would even understand that they would have such a need, right? So it's not real difficult. People that are really blue and into conformity and structure, for them, I have to go slow, because they have to fit everything into the existing structure that they already have, and they really don't like to lose any of their existing structure. Helping people discard structure that's no longer useful to them when they're at that level is my biggest challenge. That's the hardest thing to do, but it is doable. And when they know, when somebody knows, I know I am blue, I know I am here at this place, I know there are these levels above it, I intellectually understand how they are expanded from where I am now, even if I can't quite make it my own, you know, people will move. I haven't had terrible problems with that. I have only occasionally had to say to somebody, you know, I can't help you. it happens, but usually it happens up front. Usually I'll have an initial conversation with somebody, and it's pretty easy to see what level they're at and go, well, you know, I don't think I'm the right guy for you. But, you know, I'm happy to help people even if they're not at the level where I could take them on as a client. I can still point people in the right direction. And there are people that I have ongoing dialogue with. They're not my clients. And maybe one day they will grow to be, but right now they just need somebody to ask a question to every couple of months. I'm happy to be that guy.
Mm-hmm. So who do you look up to? Who are your coaches and mentors and you know, people who you are inspired by?
Oh boy, I there's such a list here, and it comes down to. What we want to talk about in general, for specific tactics. I mean, like there's somebody that I've never met, never talked to. His name is, I believe, it's Michel Fortin. And you know, a lot of times when you encounter people online and in writing, I've never heard him pronounce his name. So I'm guessing that's how he pronounces it. He's in Quebec, and he is a copywriter extraordinaire, and he's somebody I've known of for decades, and he really influenced me early on because he made me recognize something. You know, as a neophyte marketer, we've all done this. We're excited about our features. You know, we do this and we do that. We have this bell and this whistle. And and then, of course, when you finally do a little research, you realize, don't sell features, sell benefits. Oh, okay, what's the benefit of the feature? Oh, yeah, that's really great. I get that. What Michel talks about is don't sell benefits, sell results. Mm-hmm. And that really rang my chime. You know, this, what's the result of the benefit that I care about? It's not that this car has, you know, a 400 cubic inch engine. It's that it is a powerful machine. And why do I care about a powerful machine? Well, because I think it makes me look cool. Now, there's the result that I was really after in the first place. And if I tell you about engine displacement and horsepower, you know, those features, I have to translate that as a buyer a couple of levels before we get down to what I care about. And even when you talk about benefits, you still are left with them having to translate, why do I care about this benefit? Oh, yes. Because it will make me look more stylish, because it will make me more desirable, because it will make me look smart, because it will make me look cool. You know, go straight to that. Go straight to the result thereafter. So I love that from him.
So how would you, for example, with this specific example of the car, how would you translate it? Because I imagine you wouldn't take it literally that you want to look cool, drive this car. There is a disconnect. It's not an immediate jump. So how would you take that if you were to write an ad or some kind of a marketing campaign for selling a car, what would that look like?
Well, I have to argue with you directly. That's absolutely what I would do. Look at the great, you know, we've got the big companies that are putting millions of dollars into this, and they've gotten good at it. And they get the guy with the right voice and the guy with the right look, and they put that truck out there in the mud next to the oil derrick. And I mean, they got the whole thing going on. You just reeks macho, right? You know, that's exactly what you do. They don't play anymore. And the big companies that have gotten really good at this, like Coca-Cola, for example, or McDonald's, they don't talk about what they sell. They don't talk about their product at all. They talk about this essence of life at Coca-Cola and about this, about family and togetherness at McDonald's. I mean, it's just, they have really honed it down, and they've learned that over decades. Mm-hmm. And then, like Coca-Cola, over 100 years, right? We can go straight to it. We don't have to take 100 years to get this worked out. We can go straight to this with whatever we're doing. But the thing is, they're authentic about it.
Yeah. I don't know what just happened. The cats did something, and they just blew my light out. I don't know.
But they didn't get electrocuted, did they?
No.
Oh gosh.
Now my whole lamp just collapsed here. I don't know what happened, but it went out. The light bulbs are still there.
This is powerful stuff, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my goodness. You guys should see this. It's like the whole, and I'm not going to explain it. The hot light bulbs are about to fall out.
Oh, no.
Give me a second.
Okay.
Before it falls on the floor.
You okay, Esther?
Sorry about that, you guys.
No worries.
I don't even think I can, this is like a miracle, I don't think I can blame the cats, but you know where the light bulbs attached to the video light, that whole thread yeah. just fell out and it's hanging by a thread. So I just laid wow. it down on the floor because it's too hot to touch right now.
yeah.
So weird.
Sounds like something went, okay.
Wow.
Glad well, I will not be thwarted fun. From the point I was going to make.
yes, please.
Let's hear it.
So
let's
here
hear
it. It. A lot of people, they hate on big companies. But the fact is that they've gotten to this place now because they have figured out how to be authentic about something. Walmart is authentic about low prices. Exxon is authentic about bringing petroleum products to the world. And it doesn't matter who they are. They have to be authentic. And when you see a billboard for Coca-Cola, you can feel the authenticity. It's real. They're selling sugar water, and it's not terribly healthy. But you know what? There's something authentic in their message. And it gets the closer you get to the actual result, the more important it is that you be authentic. If you're farther down the chain and you're talking features, you don't have to be authentic at all. If you're talking benefits, you know, more authentic is better. If you're talking mm-hmm. results, authentic is the only mm-hmm. thing that works. And mm-hmm. and you cannot talk results without authenticity or you will fail in your marketing effort.
So what does authenticity really mean? Because especially you know, when it's a big company, when it's a solopreneur, it's authentic to the solopreneur, and it's you know something that is real and true for the solopreneur. But when it's a bigger company, what does authenticity really mean? Is it just that it's consistent, or what is authenticity?
Okay. Well, consistency is a factor, but you can be consistently evil, you know? So
That is true.
Yeah, that's not the whole of it. There's got to be some kind of ethical base, some kind of thing you feel that I've got to do something sustainable. And I think there's a more and more of a push for this idea of sustainability in the world. And in entrepreneurism, it is the perfect place to apply it. Sustainability is merely that what I'm doing today will allow me to still be doing something tomorrow. And in a small business, you know, when I say small, I mean not Fortune 500, you will have to be something fresh tomorrow. And you're going to have to show up tomorrow. And if you burn it all out today, it's over. And so this idea of sustainability becomes critical. And so it's not about, I'm not moralizing about it. I'm just talking about you have to do that which sustains life. And it can't be just sustains your life, sustains your company life. It's got to sustain your buyer's life. It's got to sustain the marketplace's life. Or you know, you'll kill off your market. And we see companies literally doing that. And mm-hmm. you know, they're going away. You look at like say some of the tobacco companies, they had to go outside of the US market or they were dead. Mm-hmm. And they will eventually have the same problem in the broader market that they had in the U.S. market. And now it's a spiral downward for them. And, yeah. and until they change out of that, it's their attitude that started it from the beginning. It began as a natural product, but they've made it more and more and more and more unnatural to the point now where it's causing so much damage that you know they're damaging themselves.
So mm-hmm. I have a big question here. So you talked a lot about how we should try and emulate what big companies do in terms of the feel and the lifestyle and that essence that the person would have. Like tobacco would be a perfect example, actually. The Marlboro man, he looked all macho and on a horse and all those things. But those typical billboards and those types of advertisement often don't contain an offer. And what we are learning and what we are being taught is that you have to do direct response marketing so that you can measure and track everything because we don't have the budgets like Coke or
right.
Pepsi. So how do you combine the two and have that life essence feeling and at the same time make an offer?
Okay. I agree with what you're saying that most small companies can't afford to blanket the entire market with their marketing. So they have to do things that are more measurable. But I think a lot of people are measuring the wrong stuff, or they're getting excited about measuring things that are measurable instead of things that matter. Mm-hmm. You know, at the end of the day, the only thing that matters is that somebody bought.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't care how many readers you've got, or how many people came to your webinar, or how many people downloaded your free offer. I mean, those are interesting numbers, but the only number that matters is what resulted in a sale. And I think a lot of marketing efforts stop short of that. They measure things up to that. They measure indicators of it. But sales are measurable too. So, you know, we really need to get all the way to the end game. We need to know what marketing got the sale, not just what marketing got somebody on the list, what marketing got somebody to show up for the webinar, or what marketing got them to download something.
Mm-hmm. So would you say, like, you would track it overall, that let's say the most of my buyers come from when I do a speaking gig at a live event versus doing webinars versus doing an ebook or whatever. Is that the type of seeing it all the way through that you're talking about?
That's one example, but even that you have to take further. You gotta value that marketing now. You know, how much does it cost me to do a speaking gig versus how much did it cost me to run this Facebook ad campaign versus how much did it cost me to have a free download on my website? You know, you've got to value it, because you could look at something and say, hey, I get most of my sales from doing X, but if X is terribly expensive, that's not necessarily useful information.
Right, it's not scalable.
Yeah, you got to do it. You got to go end to end on this. You got to take it all the way to the end point of what there was a sale, and all the way to the starting point of what did I spend to get that person there.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And I think, or this is something that Esther and I at least talk about quite often, is, you know, one thing is money, which, you know, how much are you spending in terms of money, but also what are you actually spending in terms of energy?
Right.
Because if you are, you know, let's just say a speaking event and you are completely pooped for 2 weeks after that, well, that needs to be factored in as well. It's not the most sustainable strategy if you're doing something that first of all is quite expensive in terms of investment, but also which just drains you.
Yeah, that's, you're spot on there. That this is about self-awareness, because sometimes people do this too. They'll say, "Hey, I did a webinar and I made $20,000 in 1 hour."
I hate that. Because it's really not that 1 hour. Then you might as well be at a job and you work for a whole month and you got a paycheck, but you made the paycheck in 1 hour. It's the same idea.
Yeah, and it wasn't 1 hour. It was many hours.
Yeah.
And I love what you were just saying, Meta, about doing public speaking. If you don't factor in what happens afterward, that, you know, if something just wipes you out, all of that downtime after that has to be counted too. It matters.
Yeah.
And we all have certain finite resources. You can only speak to so many in so many places. You personally. So this is a very, very precious thing that if you're going to take your own time for it. Now, other things, you know, you might be able to do some ad campaigns that would just scale up and up, you know, far beyond your budget. So you don't have to worry about scaling it, because there's always more ad space. But but there are other things that if it's going to take my personal time, oh boy, that is super precious stuff. It's got to really give me a return.
Exactly, and also in order to make the business more sustainable, because I do see a lot of people burning out incredibly easily, because they take the logical approach, right, and think, okay, well, you know, let's just, you know, stick with the example of speaking gigs. Well, you know, one speaking gig can give me X amount of dollars, therefore I will just do, you know, 20 speaking gigs a year, and after a year, they're dead, because there's nothing left to give.
Right, exactly. And we have to look at ourselves and say what works for me. You know, for instance, my wife is a consummate salesperson, and she loves it. She's energized by making a sales presentation. Mm-hmm. I am drained by making a sales presentation.
Yeah.
It's not my favorite thing to do, and so we can't equate those things and call them equal. They're not equal. And if you are somebody that you are energized by some of these activities, well, great. Then absolutely fill your schedule. Do the most you can possibly do if it's getting you results. And for others, if it's draining you, you might want to find a way to get out of it entirely.
Yeah.
So where do emotions fit into this? Because sometimes we have to do things that we maybe especially in the beginning of the business that we are not the best at or that we absolutely hate doing, but there is no way to outsource it at the time. But if you have to do it and it drains you, it also have an impact. It also has an impact on your emotions and on your confidence ultimately. So how can you take that into account and see what really inspires you and build your business that way? Do you have any tips for us?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I was just talking with one of my clients about this just the other day. And one thing that can help is if you have an end point in mind. If you know when the suffering is going to stop, you can put up with a lot more. So in his case, he's got some things he needs to do, and he is going to make a push all the way to Christmas. Mm-hmm. And so, and he knows that it's coming at a cost right now, but he also can see the end point. It's this side of the horizon. You can't say, okay, I'm just going to do this until 2018. You know, for most of us, it's just too far to the future to be real. It's got to be somewhere that's real. And if you have something so big that I can't commit to having it done this side of the horizon, well, then break it into pieces, commit to a piece that you can do this side of the horizon, and then give yourself a break. There was a great book I read at one time called The Power of Full Engagement.
I love that book.
Yeah, and you know, their approach was to say, look, it's not about managing your time, it's about managing your energy. And they learned this from managing sports stars and saying, well, how does a person who's a professional athlete do what they do? Well, mostly they're not playing their game all the time and not competing in their game all the time. They might be practicing. They might be working out. They might be doing all kinds of things. But as far as when they are actually playing the game for the money, that's a very small part of their time. Mm-hmm. So the idea is then you'll hone it down to when that time comes, all distractions are out of the way, everything is prepared, and you're ready to go. And so they do that, they work very hard, and then they take time off. And so that's the same thing with what I'm talking about here. So if you've got to do something that's hard, and I promise you what all these professional athletes do, it's always hard for them. they will leave it all on the field, and they'll get a break. And they know that, you know, the clock is gonna run out at a certain time, and at that point it's over, and I know I'll get my rest then. Right now, though, that's why they can keep going through the fourth quarter. That's why they can play that last set. That's why they can get through the last inning, because they know this is I can push right now, and I'll rest and heal later.
So,
and we can do the same thing.
What if it's not a physical activity? But even for the athletes, they might be thinking about it when they're supposed to be taking time off. But certainly for entrepreneurs, we find ourselves thinking about that business all day long and waking up at night and still thinking about it. Do you have any advice on disconnecting completely? Like, do you have to push yourself into something that you enjoy just as much and you're fully in there? Or what would be the best way to go about that?
I can hark back to something that happened to me when I was a young man, and I was working a lot. I had a lot of clients, and they had problems to solve, and I was probably working 70 hours a week, but I was young and energetic, and it was fine. But I found myself not being able to sleep at night because I'd be thinking about the problems I'd have to solve the next day. And then after doing this for a while and really not had decent sleep in a long time, one night when I started worrying about some stupid programming problem, I said, I don't know, something just flipped in my head. I said, stop. Mm-hmm. You cannot do this tonight. This is a problem you cannot solve tonight. It'll be there in the morning. And if you want to be able to solve this problem in the morning, you need to be well rested. Mm-hmm. And I got it at that point. And I literally then every night before I got into bed, I would literally picture myself turning things off. Be visual about it. Turn everything off. Mm-hmm. Shut it down. Lock the doors. Whatever metaphor works in your own head, because there's nothing you can do about it tonight. And that was always the answer. There's just nothing I can do about it tonight. I'll work with it tomorrow. It was about be present. You know, in this moment. This moment is for sleeping, and so that's what I'm going to do. And you can do the same thing with other things. You know, so this is the moment to spend with my kids. This is the moment to have dinner with my wife. This is the moment to do whatever it is you're doing. To be at your religious services. This is the moment for me to read the paper. This is the moment for me to read a novel as opposed to yet another blog about whatever it is I do. You know, you've got to flip that switch, because if you don't, you will not be able to deliver later. If you're worried about delivering, this is the answer. You've got to break every once in a while.
Yeah, exactly.
The mental discipline.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, we call it discipline, but it's just a choice.
Yeah.
And frankly, if you're not going to make good choices, you're not going to survive. You're not going to succeed. If you really want to succeed, then make good choices. And sometimes the choice is to watch the sunset.
Yeah,
exactly. I love that.
I think it was John Campbell who defined discipline as remembering what it is we truly want. And I think that is.
Well, and again. Yeah, I was going to say, you have to know what it is first.
Yeah.
A lot of people aren't remembering it because they never figured out what it was in the first place.
Yeah, exactly.
So I have here a question that I always ask from every person that comes here to be interviewed, because it's just so crucial for us to really be able to make a bigger difference in the world. And I'm wondering what can we do to become more influential through our marketing?
Well, I think I would hark back to some of the things we've already discussed, that authenticity is going to be really, really critical, to be genuine. Mm-hmm. To actually want to do the greatest good that can be done. Greatest good means greatest for everybody. And it doesn't mean for them instead of me. It means for them and me.
Yeah.
You remember the movie about John Nash that Russell Crowe was in?
Yeah.
A Beautiful Mind.
Yes, that was
in that. In that movie, he talked about something that John Nash figured out. It was just an economic principle that up until that time they had believed that every individual caring for their own interests is what made capitalism work. But what John Nash figured out is what made capitalism work is every individual figuring out what's good for both the individual and the group. Mm-hmm. You have to do that which works for both you and for the world. And if you do that, that's when things spiral upward.
Well, thank you so much. That's fantastic. I love that advice. And Kenneth, I really want to thank you for coming today on the show and sharing so much generously of your insights and your experience. And I'm wondering, if people want to meet you and learn more about what you do, where do they go online?
Okay. Well, go to veracalaritas.com. It's veracalaritas. And that's Latin for true clarity, and you'll find that there's regular updates there all the time, so sign up for those updates, and of course, if you want to talk to me directly, you'll see there's a contact button, and you can get to me, and I have partners in the business, too. My wife is my part, and she really specializes in people that are working on their sales environment and their mission. And my adult son also works with our company, and he's got some very interesting takes on sustainability in the world.
Oh my goodness! It sounds like we'll have the whole family on the show.
Believe me, it occurred to me to bring that up to you. We have an interesting operation here, you know. There is one mission for Veracalaritas, but each of us have our own areas of expertise and specialty, and mine is entrepreneurship.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
That concludes part two of this interview with Kenneth Vogt. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. I know I had so much fun talking with Ken. And I want to thank you so much for being here and for listening. I really, really appreciate you, influencer. And I want to invite you, because we have a new community. You might have heard me mention it before. And it's called the Born to Influence Community, where we exchange strategies and resources and all kinds of marketing gold that we don't get to talk about here on the show. And you can get there in one of two ways. Either type into your browser, Born to Influence Community, or if you happen to be on Facebook right now, just type in the search bar there, Born to Influence Community, and it will take you to the group page. Click request to join, and I'll be able to approve you there, and we'll get to hang out there together. All right? And I hope to see you there soon. And otherwise, I will see you with a brand new interview on Monday. Same time, same place.